Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Moving Spotlight Podcast. This episode is going to be sick. It's going to be so sick. And by sick, I mean I am sick, not like as the young people say, cool. I mean, yeah. Our guest is awesome, but I'm a little under the weather, but I'm still here because this is too important, Corbin.
It's too important.
This guest is too important. I could not cancel. You see how passionate I am today? This is what this guest brings out of me. I'm super excited that he's here, but we're gonna hold off on that for a second. Corbin, this is a topic I got to throw you under the bus. You picked, thank God. Skincare routine. Jesus, skin what am I talking about?
Skincare routine. You got to keep it tight.
It's not that I don't do it. I just, I don't want to be responsible for it. So Corbin, talk to me about keeping it tight.
John had to leave early, so I was in full ownership of the topic this week.
Never leave the brainstorming session early when you're planning for a podcast, because then skincare comes up. Who knows what's next?
The reason it was on my mind, I've only recently gotten into it because a couple of my friends were talking about it, and I forget what sparked it. I think I saw like a blackhead on me, and I was like, oh no, it's happening. It's happening. It's already going downhill. But yeah, I've been trying to get better. I'm really bad at nighttime doing it. I don't know about you, but I just like, when I'm tired, I just go lay down, I fall asleep. So I want to get better at like doing like all the, like, you know, whatever the squalene stuff that you put on that night and do all that stuff. I don't even know what they are anymore. But my friends, I text them and they gave me a whole grocery list of like all these ordinary products, this like scentless face cream thing. And I was like, all right, I guess this is me now. So when I travel, my to-go bag is massive.
Amazing. Okay, so if the audience is listening and they need like one, what's the secret, like what's the secret sauce, like what's one thing that you can tell them that maybe people aren't, you know, using?
Yeah, the one that I found, because I didn't realize how dry my face felt, you get so used to it. I forget exactly what the thing is, but it's the Ordinary's the product, and it's something B5, it's some percentage, and plus B5, it's you can get it on Amazon. But it's one that I put on and then just put lotion on, and that will just like, my face feels so much better after doing that. And it's weird, because like when I don't put it on, I was like, I lived like this. Like, this is how I was for so many years. But I forget the name of it exactly. It's I think it's B5%. It's like plus, I can picture it in my brain, but you can look it up on Amazon. It's kind of the main one that they sell.
Yep.
What about you? What do you do? How do you keep it toy?
it's funny you say that. I feel like I feel like my wife got me into a little more of a skin, and it's great. I mean, I do appreciate it. And you got it. I think for me it was like the crow's feet.
Oh, the crow's,
your eyes. Yeah, you notice that and you're like, what's going on there? Like, why is that happening? <That's new. laughs> And so I think that was the first thing I got, was like a little, it's like the tiniest thing of Neutrogena, and you're like, $30. You're like, all right, this thing better work, you know? But it's like a little Neutrogena, you know, for kind of around the eyes. I started with that, and it's funny you say that. Even when I'm tired, I guess I like routine. I'm very much like, I put out all my things in a line. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of go down the line.
I do that too.
Yes, I totally get it, where I don't want to do it. I do remember also there used to be a spa in like West Hollywood called like Olaf Hendrickson or something like that. You've been there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe it's still around. But I remember I went in there, this was like many years ago, for like a facial, and I'm laying down and I'm like, okay, this is going to be like relaxing, like a massage. And then the lady's like popping out blackheads, and I'm like, what is going? She's like, this was in your face. I'm like, oh my God, it's like a black snake. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like that was kind of eye opening to me. Like just the stuff that, you know, kind of absorbs.
Yeah. It's weird. You don't realize that you're like, your face is like a sponge. It's just breathing in everything all the time. And it's gross.
It is. And actually, you know, it's funny you're talking about that. I think the face happens. And now for me, this is funny, with age, now you start thinking about your feet. You're like, do I need to moisturize my feet? Like,
yeah, I'm not there yet.
That's so funny. It's like, this is like a stand-up routine. This is like an age thing. I'm telling you, when you get older, all of a sudden you're like, you know, our guest is shaking his head agreeing with me, because it's so funny, Corbin. I've never thought about this, but it's like, it's now like the feet are included, and you're like, you know, trying to,
this is not gonna be a good time.
No, it's not. It's just another thing on the list of that sucks about getting older. Well, I think we've exhausted my knowledge on skincare, definitely. Gone way deeper.
Yeah, I was very service level as well.
Good topic. Our guest looks super youthful, so I'm sure he's got some great tips.
Yes.
And sunscreen. Wear your sunscreen if you're somewhere sunny. That's important in the morning. I want to get to our guest right away. I'm excited that he's here. Great energy, great guy. I've known him for a while. Actor and founder of the Actors Network, Kevin E. West. Hey, Kevin.
Oh my God. Hi guys.
Hello. That was going crazy.
Could anybody have told me the intro to this was going to be skincare and then we're going to transition to feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you going to cancel or are you loving it?
No, I'm going to be honest with you though. I did not expect Blackhead to be in the episode that I'm going to be
can't
straight
leave
up
me
with
alone.
You.
This is what happens.
And yeah, I think I needed to be in that meeting. No, actually the odd part is, first of all, I have a huge thing with the fact that, and again, I'm from the rural South and I grew up as basically a Huckleberry Finn in a certain way, but I have a huge issue with the fact that men don't pay closer attention to their hygiene, and especially Corbin, to your point, feet. I am a, oh my God. I mean, we're trying to discuss the entertainment business and I'm on a foot fetish. And we just got started. But I have a huge issue. And again, I can't speak for you guys, but I can only tell you as a lifelong athlete, which is what I wanted to do before I got into this profession. I have a real issue with men who don't take care of their feet. And I just think about their partner who they went baby with. I'm like, no one wants to be crawling in bed with that dude. You can't have like fungi toes since you're a 35. So it's, you know, we got fungi and blackhead in the first 10 minutes. So I don't
know.
Now that everyone
switched off the podcast, we really got to the good stuff right away. They did not know they're here for this.
But I did lose a dear friend to melanoma early in my life. And I did a 10-year celebrity golf tournament on behalf of him. So yes, sunscreen and protect that skin, baby, for sure.
For sure. Yep. That's one that, you know, comes up all the time as kind of the lowest level of the pyramid, you know, in a good way of like, this is, if you're going to start somewhere, start with that. So, well, Kevin, we're so glad you're here. I think because you kind of mentioned it, can you just give us, you know, where you're from, how you got into acting, entertainment? You know, I'm sure you've told the story before, but
I'm going to truncate it though. So that Corbin doesn't fall asleep during this. Yeah. Like I said, I grew up in a single parent home in rural Tennessee, and I, like a lot of people, wanted to be a professional athlete. That at the time would have been golf. I'm still a single digit, but long story short, I wound up, I don't know how much your audience may or may not be aware of, a thing these days, a talent, kind of difficult conversation for me called IMTA. But way back in the day, I got drug into sort of a modeling school in Nashville, rural Nashville, when I was going to school at MTSU. And
yeah, there used to be like John Robert Powers was another. There's a couple of them.
I mean, that's the good analogy. It wasn't perfect analogy, John.
The bottom line is,
I raised money to go to this big competition in New York. And of course, they had three categories, and one of them was runway, and two of them were runway and fashion. I was not competing in those two. I'm 5'10" and I do not look like Brad Pitt. So the only third category was commercials. And, you competed in all of them, but I had no shot at the other two. But against about 500 people from around the entire country, I won. And I wrote and produced the commercial, and I won it. And that sort of was, as I was winding down the dream of being a golfer for a whole bunch of family and life reasons we don't need to go into. It takes a lot of support to be a professional athlete. So that's kind of what led me. I'm actually staring at the trophy sitting here in my studio that I won back then. But that led me to go to Atlanta back before Atlanta was Atlanta. And I spent 2 years there and did Made in Heaven with Timothy Hutton, blah, blah, blah. And then I came to Los Angeles where, as we like to say, the rest to this moment is history. There you go.
Great. And just fast forward, we're kind of jumping around a little bit here, but I'm curious kind of your involvement with, you know, the Actors Network and what that is for people that are curious, because I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, you had to be a self-starter to do that. You know what I mean? So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's such a different era. You know, when you go from analog to digital, from the 20th century to the 21st century. And, you know, honestly, John, it took me a long time to understand. I mean, I woke up out of a dream and I wrote a bunch of stuff down, and you know, the organization itself before Jerry Maguire, I always have to make that qualification to that movie. The mantra that was help us help you help all of us. And I was told, you know, you're never going to get actors to actually help each other. We're too selfish and too narcissistic. And I said, that just was more of a challenge to me. But what I genuinely saw as a guy who had sort of been a psychology double major in my first 4 years here, I just saw what I thought was a lot of unnecessary frustration, emotional pain, blah, blah. And I just, you know, I just thought to myself, same as I'm sitting here looking at the two of you, you know, it's a competitive industry, but it really, to me, has never been an individual competition. Mm. It's just not the way that I view the art of even trying to make money as an on-camera or a voice performer. And so it just started out in my apartment having a meeting. And the next thing I know, 23 and a half years of my life went by. Yeah. We did, you know, we still to this day, I closed the physical doors in 2013 because of the internet, essentially. But a lot of your guests, from Michael Donovan to Justin to a lot of the people you've had on, you know, it was the only business organization of its kind. It was not a casting workshop entity. It was a genuine business information education organization. And now, you know, because of the internet, you have a whole litany of people out there who feel that they can coach and or give advice on the business side. And all I can say is I started in 91, and a lot of what's out there, with respect and not trying to sound too over the top on it, a lot of that stuff came out of the Actors Network and what that organization was. But I just believe that the business was much more than what people tend to lean towards it, which is what I call the setup. And that's just getting pictures and getting representation. And I always make a joke that's like buying, it's like buying ski clothes and renting the skis, but you can't get off the chairlift. thank you. I appreciate it. Always going for a laugh. Former stand-up comic, former improv artist. And so I just always felt that people didn't really understand how to address. And a lot of this happened along the way, John, as it does. It happened with mistakes that I made and things that I succeeded at. And slowly the organization evolved. And in 95, we had our first office. And in 98, there was a double page spread on us in Backstage West. And essentially, it was always about, for me, deciding what you were going to do. If you didn't hit it and get that skyrocket career within the first 3 years, what do you do then? And we are, to me, and we still are, the most uneducated professional community in the world, bar none, just simply because all of our major arts universities don't have any kind of ongoing curriculum to actually explain to people what I know. And so that's kind of how it started.
Yeah. With that, Kevin, one of the ideas that kind of popped in my brain, just for people listening, is, you know, I know it's different than this, but if someone... I like what you said about people working together, and this isn't what you said, but it's kind of like, what would you advise someone if they wanted to kind of start something like an accountability group, something like a group to kind of, you know, support each other, is what I'm saying, versus like compete with each other, other actors. How would you suggest someone kind of goes about starting something like that? You know, even
well, the irony, John, is that to this day, we called, essentially, I called them sessions, but then I eventually called them power groups. And some of our power group people even still actually meet to this day their own. And there were several other acting coaches, sort of entities around the town that between 91 and let's say 2000 or 2001 sort of brought that element into a part of their school or their acting classes. And what we did and what was so powerful was we had both goals that you had to state what you've been doing and what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. that was the basis for the power groups, as we went around the room and you had to write it down and you had to say what you've done for the last 30 days and what you intend to do for the next 30 days. And then my entire favorite part, and it's what my business expertise coaching was always on, was then we had what we called actor issue time. And we may not like the word issue, but the bottom line is, this profession is anything but black and white. It's 98% of it is subjective. That's why I've always made dating jokes as similar to pursuing the business of acting, or just casting is subjective. So we would go around the room with what things had come up. And part of that conversation would always lend itself to people who've experienced this class or experienced that service or had gone in an audition for that person, could actually share some insight, the same as you would do, quote unquote, on a dating profile or in the first 10 minutes of going out with somebody. You ask questions, you get to know them because the subjectivity of this profession when it comes to being, sorry to, you know, reference Death of a Salesman, but being likable, Being enjoyable out at networking events, knowing how to talk to people if you run into them at Starbucks. This is a lot of the challenge as a human product for sale that we simply don't get any education on. And that's a that would be what I would tell people to do in terms of trying to have your own sort of small group and support each other. And it just can't be about, you know, gloating. It can't be about trying to squirrel things away. It has to be something to understand, no matter how similar you are in type. When I go in and I read my 4 or 5 pages as I have an audition tomorrow, it's even if I was twins with someone, we're not going to read them the same, mm-hmm. and to let that crap go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love, Kevin, one of the ways I looked at this early on when I was out here is this idea of abundance versus scarcity. You know what I mean? You said squirrel things away, and I still really lean into abundance versus scarcity. I think there's always opportunities, there's always things happening, and I've just found, especially if you're in it for the long haul, you know, trying to have that mentality doesn't, you know, of there's a limited amount. You're right. You know what I mean? It just doesn't serve. It doesn't serve mm-hmm. you. Doesn't serve anyone.
It's way more better to be that positive about things too.
Yeah. It keeps your mental frame. Here's a question, Kevin. I'm curious with what you were kind of talking about, and you mentioned kind of universities. I'm just curious your thoughts. This could be a hot take.
You want to ask me?
Yeah, that's why I'm asking it. I'm excited. I'm getting a little goosebumps.
Corbin just backed away from the
mic. Yes, he did. Corbin's like, I am not co-hosting. No. Kevin, why do, and maybe this is changing a little bit, but I still kind of know a little bit, why do universities focus, and I love theater, focus so much on theater, and it feels like on camera, kind of TV film. Do you feel that way or not? Like, I feel like
I feel that way as a paradox. I think that they focus on it as part of their curriculum because it is the foundational part of, quote unquote, the craft of acting, show business, right? The show being craft, business being all the stuff about money. But they will certainly utilize anybody who's successful out of their university in terms of marketing their university. They'll they'll use Meryl Streep, and they'll use people who went to some, you know, NY or Harvard or Yale or whatever it may be. They'll use any success from a marketing standpoint. But my certainly, and this is obviously just my opinion, but I think it's a pretty solid answer, is they don't like the business. And the reason why they don't like the business is because they want people to actually spend money at the university to get an arts degree, to have that piece of paper. And the truth of the statistics of the business is not something that's a real attractive sale point. Mm-hmm. So people used to ask me all the time, well, how come even in a city like UCLA or USC or some other places, how come they don't have an ongoing curriculum? I mean, I was the first person to create an actual annual actor business education curriculum. And I said it was for two reasons. One is they don't have people who are teaching, who are professors at those universities who have experienced and know what I know and present it. And the other is they don't want reality in their curriculum. They don't want the percentage of 2% of actors, blah, or they don't want that. And so that's why they tend to me, focus on just the craft, and the foundation of that is obviously based in live stage, and so to most people, and it's natural. It's you don't have to try and push that or sell that. It's normal to just so. Well, today we're going to get on stage. We're going to actually do this. You know, that that's an easy thing that would be natural and normal to do.
And Corbin, that is true. Every professor at USC is British.
So yes, that's an accurate portrayal.
Yeah, it's an accurate portrayal.
I actually knew that. That's
yeah, you did know that already. Yes.
Okay, I was curious about kind of in that same world, like how do actors know, how do they get to learn the business side of acting without kind of like a lot of people are very ignorant of it. And it seems like at schools, like we're talking about, they don't talk about it. And like theater is a whole separate world. Like we're you're holding up your own book. I like it.
Yeah.
I like
it. Tell us about this book. Tell us about the book.
Well, I mean, you know, with all respect, the reason why we don't know about it is because if you want to be a doctor or a policeman or a fireman, or you want to go into advertising, or I can pick 15 or 20 different sectors, or even just a basic political science degree or a basic business degree. We have so much support in all forms of schooling in lots of ways, especially when you get into maybe more of a private school, which again was not my experience at public school, you know, very, very low sort of income kind of childhood. The bottom line is that people don't discuss it. Mm-hmm. And when they discuss the business, Corbin, what they tend to do is they do what I just said a little while ago. They discuss the setup of it, mm-hmm. which is get into a class, get some pictures taken. Nowadays, obviously, for the last 2+ decades, it's, you know, have an online profile, go spend your money with the casting sites, and then submit and try and get a representative. Good luck. Mm-hmm. And that again to me is very akin to buying ski clothes and renting boots and skis and having no idea actually what you're going to face when you go through the mechanics of trying to get on and off a chairlift. The knowing how to ski part is a little bit more the show to me. It's a little bit more analogous to the craft, but there are a lot of mechanics to all of these. And so people don't ever really discuss the business. They don't discuss what I would call, you know, proactivity and how you go about target list. You guys probably have heard target list several times. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist before I started the Actors Network. Target list came out of the Actors Network in 1991. But how do you go about assessing? Why would you choose? What questions do you ask when you go into an agent meeting? What's the difference between an agent and a manager? Why do we have that confused? All of these things that have to do with what I would call the most important part of the business, which is your psyche. Mm-hmm. How do you think about being an actor? How do you deal with what happens as a performer in your mind with either results and or the process we go through to try and book work? So we just don't have a real good support system for that. And so it kind of is just forever perpetuating that people don't really understand how to deal with or assess New York, LA, or Chicago, or any other major market.
Mm. Yeah, you know, Kevin, I appreciate you saying that because I think that's one of the things I find a lot of classes are either kind of about like, you know, the craft or the business. It's like there's a chasm between them, you know. And in my classes, because I've worked in casting and been an actor, you know, I try to kind of help on both sides. I'll try to say, you know, hey, the craft is really right. The craft is really important, but the business is also, you know. And so you kind of need to have an awareness. And so we'll talk about both of those things. And I find there are a lot of question marks. There is a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of like, we don't know. And like you're saying, it feels sometimes like a black box. And a lot of times, the only reason people know is because they've been through it. That's the only way to find out, which can be really challenging. But like you were holding up your book. So like, tell us a little bit about your book and kind of what that.
Oh, well, I sat down, I first initially started the idea of writing this, honestly, John, in around 95 or 96. Ha ha, not a joke. And initially back then, I was going to do it as 5 books. This is kind of what had evolved in the first 4 or 5 years of the Actors Network of building this curriculum. And I was going to do it like school. I was going to do freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and a grad. And I was going to have them be 25 chapters per book, about 10 pages per, that's 250 pages a book. This is normal for way back when. And that's how I was going to do it. It never happened because I worked all the time and I was running this company and relationships and life and blah. And so then I finally, when I closed the network, and we had gotten into the digital world, I finally sat down in 2014, 2015, and I finally wrote the damn thing. And I used the 7 deadly sins as the premise to it for a reason, in that my whole thing with the business has always been, we do, Corbin, we try to bifurcate the business away from the show in a way which is normal, but I don't think it actually is helpful. There's plenty of business that's in the show. Just being punctual to class would be a business statement about going to acting class. And there's also a lot of show in the business, in that having a conversation with somebody in a networking situation requires a certain craft of you as a human being. And it's not just black and white business stuff. And so when I looked at the 7 sins, I thought if you put the word actor in front of the sins, it becomes an interesting premise on what I had been talking about at that point for over 25 years. And, you know, actor lust, actor greed, actor gluttony. You're sitting here talking, John, about scarcity versus abundance. Mm-hmm. And now let's go on the ones that are really fun. Actor wrath. Mm-hmm. How many angry actors do you know? Mm-hmm. Actor envy. You know, and how that can just desecrate yourself and your career in terms of your enthusiasm. And then the irony is that all the 7 sins are actually predicated on what was considered the worst of all, which was pride. And so I took that premise and I basically broke down what I had been doing for a long time. And I used it as a challenge and a trap and a solution. Why is actor lust a trap, and what is the solution to it? And so it took all of the tangible sort of mechanisms I had built through the Actors Network, but it put it into a human mentality regarding the sins and an emotional reality regarding the sins. And I did it as traps and solutions. And that's the basis for Seven Deadly Sins, The Actor Overcomes.
Okay. Wow, well, that's that's wonderful. That's a resource, Kevin, and I appreciate you putting putting in the time into a book and could, kind of putting your thoughts on paper. It's so nice to have that, and I'm a big advocate of obviously the doing, but the reading and the asking questions and that idea of pride, I think, is a really interesting thing, because I think pride can get in the way of a lot of people, you know, because you know, careers in this business are not a you just keep climbing up the ladder. You know, I kind of call it chutes and ladders. You know, you go up and then you come down and you got to be okay with that. You know what I mean? It's like that board game, right? And that's part of it. You know, I mean, I just even saw, you know, Cillian Murphy talking, you know, the lead of Oppenheimer, and he was like, you know, it's not a planned career in a certain sense. Like, we're trying, we want to do certain things, but some opportunities come, some don't. You know, there's work time, there's gap time. I want to ask you, Kevin, because you've worked as an actor a good amount, just to kind of, yeah. Well, like one that jumped out for me, I saw, was Righteous Gemstones. How was working on that? Just had to get.
Oh, it was a blast. Yeah. Danny McBride was great, and I think one of the fun parts about that show for me was that, first of all, you know, we shot it in South Carolina, so I got to go, for lack of a better phrase, from a geography standpoint, I got to go quote unquote back home ish. Mm-hmm. But also, one of my dear friends from Los Angeles, who now lives in New York, was also in the episode. So that show was extremely, they're really, really tough on casting that. It's a hard show to get in for. And so it was very funny to me that a guy that I knew in 1988 in LA, we were both in the same episode. He came in from New York and I came in from LA. So that's always fun. But, yes, me playing a religious father who's of religion, but then yet smacks his son around. This is just too priceless for me, based on what the show is about, in terms of sort of being a parody of Joel Osteen. Sure. and the whole evangelical sort of church money premise. But yeah, it was a blast. Danny was great. Everybody on the show was great. It was a good time. It was a COVID thing, so it was a little odd. And I almost got stuck in South Carolina, but fortunately, I'm back.
You made it.
I made it out.
Yeah. Does your because that seems like, you know, very intense, very deep. Does your prep change at all when it comes to something that is that kind of world, or do you kind of, like, how does your prep factor in when it comes to, like, working on Criminal Minds versus something like this, or like,
Most of my prep artistically is pretty similar. And I think one of the reasons it is, you know, clothing and wardrobe, I think, is much more valuable than necessarily we give it credit for, depending on who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. And there is a very cathartic element that I discovered about myself. Now, mind you, this is individual. I'm a Pisces. I grew up very tough and rough, but I'm still an artistic Pisces. And when I put certain clothing on, it does actually a lot for me, and I can't necessarily say that every actor feels that way, nor would I presume it. So there's a certain element of prep that I don't feel I've needed to do many years, because when I step into wardrobe, there's some elements of prep that I think get taken care of for me. So I try to keep it very, very, very similar, based on the couple of coaches that I had, rest their souls, they're all gone, in terms of what, you know, in very much what am I trying to accomplish, and where does this, what is this person's basic baseline? Now, we could spend hours on all of us, what we do when we break down a script, and we can't do that. But my prep doesn't tend to change a lot overtly, depending on the show. I look at the premise of the show. I think it's more, now I sound like Spinal Tap, right? Like, it's levels, you know, must go to 10, this goes to 11. It is much more, I view a human being as a soundboard in a music studio. And so for me, it's much more the choice is here, but is that choice a 3 or a 7?
I like this.
Based on, and that is because once I make those decisions intellectually or mentally on the left side of your brain, then I can let it go and I can run with it on the right side of my brain. So for me, whether it's Criminal Minds or whether it's Lost or whether it's Righteous Gemstones or whether it's, you know, a half hour sitcom, for me, it's just really about picking the dials on my soundboard that I want to use and then which level I'm putting at. And honestly, it makes it easier. It makes it easier for me to be directed, I believe, when someone just goes, you know, hey, can you, because directors are not particularly terrific in television at saying anything other than being result oriented, go faster, go slower. It's not so much the why of why we're going faster or slower. And so that's, my prep doesn't change an awful lot. It's really just about the level.
Yeah, I like that, Kevin. And a lot of times that's can be the actor's job of the why underneath, you know, you need to go faster. It's like, well, why? Okay, there's more urgency.
Always.
Right,
always.
Exactly. Like, how do we find that? And I like what you're saying too, because I do think, you know, script analysis, being able to break down a scene, figure it out, you know, however you want to do that. And then kind of this idea of a bit letting it go so you can be responsive and reactive, but you've done that work beforehand, like you said, with one part of your brain, and then the other part of your brain kicks in, you know, which is a little more instinctive, a little more creative, a little more, you know, now I'm already on the zip line and going.
Right. But that's also something that I do. I mean, I've worked with actors in working with them on how to actually interpret a director based on your own work. Because if something has some pace to it or some urgency to it, let's just pick up, you know, a random thing that you picked up a script, John, and this guy has, there's an urgency to what they've written in front of you. It's like, I already have three different forms of urgency. Mm-hmm. I'll pick one for the audition. Mm-hmm. But if someone were to say, or if I was on the set, well, we need to bring that urgency down or pick it up. Well, that's the difference. Am I late for a meeting? Do I really have to go to the bathroom? Or am I in the car trying to get my wife because her water broke? Right. There's three different forms of urgency that I'll invent for myself. And then all I have to do is just plug and play. Now, that's how I work. But I will absolutely have chosen the why of why is this guy going at the pace that he is? And I will have already chosen that. And I'll have a primary and then I'll have two others.
Kevin, let me ask you this. In the age of self-tapes, is something Corbin and I have been discussing. How do you approach it if they're like, we want two different takes? What do you do with that? Do you ever get that, come into that situation?
Just had it. Just had it the other day for a commercial. But I mean, again, for me, the process, I try not to, because I'm a huge advocate of self-tapes from the standpoint of digital flexibility based on booking out and not having to necessarily always be quote unquote in town. But as an actor, and again, somebody who's been doing this, you know, my first guest star was Matlock in 1990. So I've been doing this since, you know, Corbin wasn't even born, I don't think. No, thank you very much. You know, talk about skincare.
Yeah, yeah. To stay young.
Yeah. I hate self-tapes as a platform. I loved being in the room. I mean, I read for Tarantino twice for Reservoir Dogs. He was 4 feet away from me. I love that. But I also love the flexibility digitally of self-tapes. And so when you have different choices, I would say to your audience that I think the thing that maybe is more necessary with self-tapes is really have to take a moment, whatever that moment means to you, because a moment to some people is 15 seconds and somebody else it's 2 minutes. But I really think you have to stop, aside from just hitting literally stop on your phone recording, and really readdress what that other way to go is, because it's so easy. And I also am an advocate of, you know, don't do 27 takes. This is something that Hollywood and other places discovered during COVID is that people looked really good on their self-tape and they got to the set and they couldn't do it. And a lot of that was because we keep doing something until we feel we get it right. But if you're not the star, you don't get that in the real world. That's part of my business thing too, Corbin, is the real world is, even when you're a top of show guest star, and the coverage is on you, you might get two takes. Three, probably only because a plane flew through and the sound or something. So I try to practice taking a moment and really shifting on your choice for that other way to go, John. And I also try to make sure that I limit myself to three or four takes in any one effort, because the truth of the matter is you aren't going to get more than that.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting because there some are starting to kind of offer some more in-person things. And I think people have gotten used to self-tapes, and it's kind of, there's a little bit of a balance. You got to figure out what works for you, like you're saying, Kevin.
And then there's a Zoom audition, which is in between. It's yes, weird. Exactly. Yeah. It's weird.
You know, and it's funny, I had a Zoom audition where I was partnered up with someone. This was for a commercial also. But I had to pretend she was sitting next to me, kind of, but I had to respond to her on the screen, if that makes sense. That was very challenging.
It like, just happened.
Really, right?
Just yes. happened. Geico I mean, commercial yeah. in the car, yeah. and she's yes. here, but on the screen, yeah. she's three squares over.
Exactly.
Like Hollywood Squares with Paul Lynn. I'm like, yeah. she's over there, but she's yep. next to me. And again, these are all, yes, yep. Yes, yes, yes. And it's hard to get good at that if you don't do it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, yes. That's definitely true. All right, Kevin, I want to get into another one where we're going to lose more listeners. No, maybe not. I'm joking.
I haven't even commented on blackheads since we discussed skincare. Come on, man.
Or feet. No, I'm totally joking. This is actually important. I'm curious about your involvement with, you know, with the union, with the conservatory, with negotiating committee, the strike. How did you end up kind of getting involved with the union, teaching there, like things like that, you know, wherever you want to start. But I just think that's a lot of actors, you know a SAG-AFTRA, they know it, but they're not tapped into it at all. And I know you're tapped in, is my point.
I am now. And the irony is that, you know, during the heyday of the Actors Network, I literally used to bring the union into the Actors Network, where I would have representatives from SAG or AFTRA at the time being separate. And I would, that's one of the reasons I know Jonathan Handel for 16 years, because he came in as a speaker. So the organization was all about education, but I close the organization, some time passes, I write the book. And then I genuinely, John, started based on what I was seeing at the union. I started being a little concerned out of respect for my pension, you know, which I've worked hard to earn.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, as the old joke goes, you know, you can talk about knowing the sausage all you want, but if you don't know how it's made, then it's hard to address any challenges you have with that. So that's basically I'm using sausage as a sale point to all actors that if you are a union, please get involved. But I decided in 2017, I became a part of this grassroots private group called Union Working. And that sort of led me, and I knew enough people at the union that it wasn't as hard for me to get involved. And I was a longtime working veteran, so it was a little bit easier. But that's what started it for me, was concern for my pension in early 2017, which now has led all the way to, you know, yes, I'm on the National Disciplinary Committee, and I was the chair of the LA Organizing for the last 4 years. And I was a co-vice chair on the conservatory with Sean and Kevin McCorkle. And I also negotiating committee three times in this past negotiating committee, obviously for this contract with a strike with AI, was quite a road to hoe. But that's how I slowly got involved. The biggest thing is, if you're going to choose to volunteer, it's all volunteerism, with the union, you have to actually do it because you want to do something, not just to be able to say when you're having a coffee that you're on a committee. That's one of the problems or challenges with the union, is that you have a lot of people who want to be on something, but they don't necessarily want to do something.
Mm-hmm. Talk about a little bit. You mentioned SAG Conservatory, which I think is a great place. I've taught there. What's been kind of the evolution of that?
Well, the conservatory goes all the way back to when I first moved to California, and we up until, I think it was 3 years ago, John, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I think up until 3 or 4 years ago, the conservatory had an arrangement with AFI, with the American Film Institute, mm-hmm. in which we were able to use their facilities for a lot of the events and such. And that agreement has now ended after some, I don't know, 45 or some years that we had that arrangement. And there are some spaces at, I think, the foundation and also at HQ, but I believe the conservatory is also trying to engage with LA Film School. But the conservatory is, you know, is a place to learn from for almost free as part of your membership, from people who have been vetted and are qualified to talk on whatever it is they're speaking on. So, you know, if you're, I joined the conservatory because you also have, you know, an association of being cast in AFI films. That's still, that association with AFI and their directors still exists in terms of that. But it is a good place to, let's say, get to know peers, practice your craft, learn more from other people who might know more than you do. And it's certainly something that I am a large advocate of.
Yeah. Well, I think there's so many places. You mentioned SAG Foundation, which I love, and Conservatory. I think there's so many places that are, you know, trying to make money off of actors. And I think yes. It's one of those great resources, like you said, where actors can go and if they want to work on their craft, because I think the repetitions and the doing is so important. You got to find that, whether it's on set, whether it's on short films, whether it's in class, you know, you got to get those reps in. So I think it's a wonderful resource. That's why I'm glad, you know, and appreciate, thank you for, you know, working on it and doing things
sure. like that. Sure, 100%.
How was it, Kevin, being part of the, you were part of the negotiating committee on the most recent?
Yes, sir.
How was, I know it was it enlightening? I mean, you know, enough to get too specific. Was it a grind? Were you happy?
I've done it more than once.
You have? Okay. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've been on other, theatrical negotiating committees.
Did this feel like other ones? Or
no, this would be about the opposite end of the Grand Canyon.
Roughly. The North Rim to the South Rim. Okay.
Yeah. Corbin, did that add up where I was at with that?
Yes.
Think about the Grand Canyon. And the reason it was, John, is because of timing. You know, so again, I make a lot of jokes about, we talk a lot about in this profession of timing, the timing of casting, the timing of a lot of things that you can't put your finger on. There's a lot of black and white to negotiations. There's a lot of that. However, the negotiation process is that there's a lot of subjectivity in that. And you had 44 people from across the country, from New York to Chicago to the mids and small locals and Los Angeles, either in a room or some form of a hybrid of in a room and on Zoom, you know, dealing with a base foundational contract that's 1,200 and some pages long, which I have read, and I'd have to read it 100 more times to know it backwards and forwards. But this negotiation, because of AI, I don't think there'll ever be a negotiation as unique as this one was, when you are still dealing with what we would call analog basic math stuff in a contract negotiation and basic tangible things such as intimacy coordinators and or stunts. And then you had something that was as existential an issue as AI. I think it made, and the hard part for me was I understood it. I had no problem with anybody who wanted to vote no, but please come up with a solution as to how we're going to do better if we do. And I had no problem with people who only focused on AI. I understand. If AI had not been a part of this negotiation, John, what we succeeded in doing, they would have given us a ticker tape parade. Instead, I spent 7 months of my life and again volunteering, and I got yelled at a lot. I understood it. You know, I signed up for it, man, and I'm not built that way. If I was a third baseman in baseball, if I sign up for something, it's, you know, bring it on. Mm-hmm. And so that was a huge part of this. The challenge being is, you know, I will say this, and this is important about to me, to your audience, and about anything we see comes from negotiations. Until we finally get the top, was that three or four tops? Mm-hmm. The top 1%, actually more notably the top 0.5% of our profession to actually truly stand with us with a metaphorical baseball bat in their hand, we're not ever going to be able to truly succeed at negotiations. So based on that fact, I would say that all of what we gained and all of what we got, even though it is not perfect, I will still stand by the fact was pretty, pretty damn close to the nth degree of what we could have gotten.
Yeah, that's amazing. Is there anything that you can see, like, because AI is in its infancy and it's going to be changing throughout, you know, the next 10 years or whatever. Is there anything that you see? Because you said we got very as close as we can be, but when it comes to like moving forward and like kind of rehashing it out, like what does that look like in your world? Because you don't want that, right? You don't want to kind of keep perpetuating the stalling out of shows and things, but you also kind of need to, depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, there are, Corbin, and there's some pros and cons to that. And the reality is this, one of the things that was frustrating for me was a lot of what I got thrown at me during the negotiations of, you know, see what I did in AI in 10 minutes. Yes, I can see that what you did, but that's not a believable person on screen. Mm-hmm. And so the quality of AI to try and create a digital replica and replace John 3 days out of his 5 days on a top of show guest star, that isn't just something you wake up and push a button and do. Mm-hmm. You may be able to push a button for ChatGPT. Will we get there someday? Yes. In the meantime, it costs, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 to create an actual walking, talking, human-like digital replica. And there's still even question marks. And I tell everybody to go back and watch Indiana Jones and Dial of Destiny, where for 12 minutes, Harrison Ford in a close-up, and parts of that, they use parts of AI. They also spent $500,000 doing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the average television show can spend that on a background mm-hmm. actor or on somebody who has four lines. So there's a lot of natural fear, and I get that. But there's also has to be some logic in terms of how that technology is going to get infused into our profession and have someone sitting at home actually believe that's Corbin Coyle or John Ruby mm-hmm. as an AI entity, as opposed to a real, you know, person standing there. So I think there's a lot of that. But also, there were six or seven sentences, as I call them, that I would prefer to have gotten in this negotiation. And the bottom line is, man, we have to get them for next negotiation. We have to. Mm-hmm. Things with regards to privacy or personal IP or storage, protectionism. But here's the thing. And as my good friend Walker always says from New York, there's always a thing. Here's the thing I'd want your audience, thank you very much. There's a thing that I'd want your audience to understand. One of the great things about what we don't know yet is the more people, and there's always somebody out there. Remember, there's a lot of OpenAI, right? It's literally a thing, OpenAI. A lot of the people out there who are going to try and do something are what we saw the deep fake with Tom Cruise 6 years ago. So they'll always go to pick on people who are really big stars, just as they recently did with Taylor Swift, right? And that's actually a good thing for us, as opposed to John or me or you, Corbin. When someone in AI goes and tries to screw with somebody who truly is an A-list person on camera in any sector, what's going to happen is we're going to wind up faster to the Supreme Court than we could have ever done on our own. Mm-hmm. And that is a good thing. And that would be one of the things I want everyone to have to take to heart in a positive way is the more you see these stories of, oh, my God, see what they're doing with AI. It's like, yes, but to whom are they doing it to? And the bigger the star, the bigger the lawsuit, the more money they have to back up their own personal image and likeness, or NIL, right, in college sports. And that's better because it's transcendent, known as case law for all of us. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, Kevin, thank you for your time with doing that. I mean, it really, yeah. it sometimes, you know, you put in those 7 months, and I sometimes think about this. I mean, I do think about this a lot when it's like you throw, like, let's say you throw a little party and someone's like, well, why don't you have this and this? And you're like, I spent 5 hours, 10 hours planning this party and putting, you know what I mean? It's like, so don't ask what's not here. And so my point with that is you putting in the 7 months, and then, you know, it's much easier to come in at the end and like, why is this not here? And I understand, you know, people can express their opinions, but I appreciate the time you put in. I know how much effort just based on you and your energy level and what you do when you're committed, and a couple other people on the negotiating committee. So thank you.
Sure. My pleasure.
Before we get to kind of our final thing, I did want to hit on one topic that I'm kind of interested in. I know it's a bigger topic, but it's really, I think it's a kind of a cool one, which is, you know, you do some speaking, some educational consulting, but what I was curious about, Kevin, is this idea of someone kind of trying to find their true purpose. It's something that I saw like kind of on your bio. How do you, like I said, it's a big topic, but I'm just curious kind of, you know, how do you talk to people about that? Because I think it's a really cool topic.
Mm-hmm. I, you know, the efforts to speak on that only come from one's own journey themselves. And the Actors Network, anything that I've done within this profession in terms of trying to assist others in areas that are not black and white, that are not as, you know, science or math based, and I took calculus twice, so I should just shoot myself in the head now, I think has a lot to do with the purpose of who you are as a person. If you truly get whatever that is, then I think you're only going to become better as an actor, number one. And I also think it gives you the ability to have something in your life that will also help keep your life balanced if it's not directly related to entertaining. And so someone who would go out and do corporate speaking, because I've spoken so many times in public regarding the education of show business, my purpose has always been simply, and I understand this, I didn't know it way back when, but I am a big advocate of people simply understanding something better. And my biggest part of that is communication. And so whatever you can find. A lot of people's purpose is honestly, they just want to raise their family, and that's fine. There's no really just to that. I shouldn't put that word in there. But whatever it is that really causes you to wake up in the morning, that's why a lot of my actor business coaching has sort of shifted a little bit over the years to being much more about being proactive about how you think about this business and how you let this business affect you negatively or positively. I do as much of that as I do anything else, but it's what drives my corporate speaking and what drives any form of anything that I write. And I recently have been a contributor to AboveTheLine.com online entity, is what is your perspective and on what your purpose does for you. And so that's my big thing in terms of someone understanding. I care mostly about my family. I care about this because a lot of us, John, want to change the world, so to speak, right? And we try to change the world a lot right off the bat as actors, and usually, you know, being able to actually affect policy or affect change, as the old joke goes, concern yourself with the effort and the result will take care of itself. It's a very common cliche. You know, maybe Taylor Swift or maybe Michael Jackson or you know, maybe somebody in our profession wanted to change the world, but they had to work in the small effort first before you can become visible enough to actually affect change, whether it's Jon Stewart or anybody else. And so I think part of your purpose, if it's not directly related to entertainment, to discover what that really is for you, you know, volunteering at the, you know, boys club, boys and girls club, or whatever that may be. My thing is, how do you keep your fuel tank in life as a human healthy? Mm-hmm. And the closer your fuel tank is to full as a human, then I believe the better chance you have at succeeding enough for whatever your purposes are to be best felt by the most amount of people. Mm-hmm. Wow, I've silenced the room with the fuel tank.
Well, I think it was good, Kevin. And I mean, I think life takes a lot of energy. I think this career takes a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And I think it, especially if you want to have sustaining power with what you're saying, you have to find that for yourself where that kind of drive comes from. And sometimes drive, you know, for some people, it's like you said, it's family. Sometimes it's like a paycheck. Sometimes in our world, you don't have either of those. You don't have a family, you don't have a paycheck. And you're right. Like, so what's giving you that drive, you know? And so you have to figure out for yourself, like, where do you, you know, how do you get excited to get up in the morning? And I think, you know, I love what you just said. And I think it, the idea of purpose and being excited about your day, one of the things I think about is, with what you said, is sometimes we want to have a bigger impact, sometimes we have a smaller impact. And I kind of think, as long as you feel like you're making progress, like you're doing things, like people are listening to you, you've got some, it doesn't matter as much if it's big or small. As you get a little older, you realize that. When you're younger, you're like, I always want to be the number one. It's like, well, that's great, but you can still make huge impacts on people around you, inspire people around you, groups you're a part of, right?
Yes, but you can only do it if you're healthy. And so you have to figure out whether or not you remain healthy because of something you do inward, like someone who reads a lot or enjoy certain things, whether you do something outward, kind of what I've done my whole life, or whether yours is experiential. I mean, I didn't know how much travel was good for my soul until I was much older in life. So whether it's experiential in doing, or whether it's inward or outward, then it gets to what you just said, John. And then it gets to, well, then how does that keep you healthy enough, your fuel tank, to then go do and have an effect on 10 people? Or whether you want to have an effect on 10,000. I've spoken to 9 people at a venue, and I've spoken to 900 people at a venue, and I would speak to 90,000 people at a venue. But the experience for me, or the purpose for me, would all be the same.
That's why Kevin likes self tapes. He's actually in Bora Bora right now. His backdrop, it just looks like an LA house or something, but it's not. He's actually in Bora Bora, enjoying the life. Yeah, because he needs that travel. He needs that experience. Awesome. Well, Kevin, so far, man, I mean, this has just been amazing. Thank you. I mean, honestly, we could do a five part book in podcast form, because you are awesome. We have
think one of the final possibilities that go from skincare. I mean,
we started at the peak, though. I mean, skincare is a big
deal. Yeah, we did. You could go right from there. The intro next time would be kiwi. You'd start with just eating kiwis and everything.
That's art.
Well, we have one final thing we like to do, which is your best bad acting. So we're going to send you a quote, Kevin. And Corbin got picked, since Corbin was in control, he picked you a short one, which is, we could have given you more of a challenge. So this is a fun one. And the point is, you can have fun with it. You can give it an accent. You can give it a little attitude. But just to kind of go over the top, and you know, you can do it whenever you're ready. It should be in your chat.
You want me to act off of that quote?
Yeah. So you just do that line, unless you want to improvise around it.
Oh, too. I'm just doing that line.
Just doing that line. Yes. Yeah.
You know, if you're good at something, never do it.
Ooh, that whisper. Good. I want to go first. Kevin, I need the rural. You got like a southern accent in you or something? Oh, I bet you do. What do you got?
Well, you ain't much, but if you're good at something, let me explain something to you, son. You best be doing that for money. Don't be doing it for free. I'll slap you upside your head.
I love it. I love it. I want to see you. I don't know what this means exactly, but I want to see you as the third baseman. What does that energy sound like to you?
If you're good at something, never do it free.
Good. I like it. Wait, one more. Baseball, but you're like, come on, boys. Like, you got to get them revved up. Mm-hmm. This is the locker. This is the locker room with that. Yeah.
If you're good at something, you never do it free.
Oh, yes.
That is why Kevin
is stone cold awful. I think a blackhead just came flying out his last thing.
And we've changed it from your best bad acting to your best awful acting. It's gone awful.
It's gone awful. All the way.
Kevin, this has been awesome, man. I appreciate it. I dragged my ass out of bed to be here, so even though I'm sick. So I'm glad I did, man. Kevin, really, you're you know, appreciate it. Hopefully people get a chance to hear you talk or, you know, learn from you, whether it's at the conservatory or just, you know, they meet you because, you know, you're out there, you're doing stuff, you're auditioning. You know, you're with the union, so, and we really appreciate that, man. Really.
Thanks. Good times. And yeah, I mean, I'm easy to find. The Actor MBA, KevinEWest.com. I'm not difficult to find, and I the last thing I hate to see people do is unnecessarily struggle. So most of you know, jokes aside, that I do anything for is to try and be of service and of assistance. Yes.
Great. So yeah, check out find Kevin either on social media or online, and his book. You can check out his book, The Seven Deadly Sins the Actor Overcomes. We really appreciate it, Kevin, so much wisdom and experience, and that you're willing to share that, you know, freely and willingly. So thank you so much. We really
appreciate it. Guys, I appreciate you having me anytime.
Awesome. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the
Moon and Fox Eye Podcast.